And Connie Willis here on Coast to Coast AM. How are you doing this Friday the 13th? I guess it's still Friday the 13th for a few people, and most people have already survived it. But you can enjoy a nice, beautiful full moon called the Harvest Moon. So you can also join me on Blue Rock. I love the moon. So then the show is Blue Rock, which is the Earth. So anyways, I love all that kind of stuff. I'm into it big time. Can you tell? Blue Rock Talk with Connie Willis is my show. And it's Earth's Most Interesting Conversations. And I have kind of a series of different shows, things called Far Out Thursday about aliens and UFOs and remote viewing and anything interesting, like bees making honey. Do you know what you're eating, right? Okay. Then Bigfoot Friday, that's all about Bigfooters out there coming and telling me about their finds. And a new show that I have, it's a project, it's a membership as well. And it is On the Road with Connie, where I take you camping 3 to 5 nights or more. Because usually things happen on the third night, and I do it virtually. You know, you sign up, and then I go there, and I broadcast from there with live chats and live streams, and you're a part of it, too. You direct me, you help me, you give me ideas, and I go out with some great researchers, Dennis Full, Sasquatch Journey, and my next one is going to be with Bobo. Yeah, Bobo's going to go. I think you guys are really, really going to like it, and so I hope you tune in. So you can go to ontheroadwithconnie.com. BlueRockTalk.tv or even Connie's Blue Rockers and sign in there with a nice little social site that I have. So I appreciate that you guys join me and you will be an official Blue Rocker at that point. So we're talking tonight. We got open lines coming up later, by the way. But right now it's Rodney Asher, a filmmaker that I just the best horror films. Very spooky, very real, very relatable to what we talk about here on Coast and what people experience. He's making a new film about simulation theory and the idea that we could be living in a computer simulation. That's just like The Matrix. And so all these other different things come in along the way, the glitches in The Matrix, the Mandela effect. And so he talks to people who believe it, experience it, and what the conclusion may be. So, Rodney, when are you more excited about when you make these films? At the very beginning with the idea, or once you get into it and things start developing and then changing course, or at the very end when you're like, and you just sit back and watch it?
I'd say it's, for me, probably about halfway through where, you know, I finished the interviews. And, of course, the interviews, when one of them is, you know, really meaty, really emotional, really, you know, filled with ideas that never occurred to me, you know, is probably a close number two, you know, and that's largely me just shutting up and letting the and letting the person tell their story. But for me, the most satisfying part, and this is the part when I can see that there's a film coming together. And that's the point where I start to intercut different people's interviews and I find different riffs on the same theme coming from different voices, that they all start to talk to each other, to overlap, to contrast, you know, and I find that I can take a half dozen sort of 3-minute little ideas, little monologues, stitch them together and have a 20-minute, 30-minute, you know, kind of passage, and I can sort of trace the flow going from one to the other to the other. That's, you know, where it really catches fire for me.
So how did you decide you were going to do this film, this subject?
Well, it's interesting because, you know, it directly grew out of the nightmare, where after we had finished filming, talking to one person, he said to me, I didn't want to say this on camera because I'm still figuring out what this means for me, but what I think is happening in sleep paralysis is that I'm seeing through the simulation. And I didn't know what he meant, you know, and he threw out the word simulation theory, which I went and looked up and started to research. And, you know, the point that he was getting at was that he thought that those shadowy people that he would see in the midst of a sleep paralysis experience was, you know, the people outside of the simulation, you know, the people who, you know, were organizing it, repairing it, editing it, setting it up. And, you know, that was, you know, really what set me off on the path. And then along the way, you know, once you start to think about something, you know, it will just pop up in front of you again and again and again, you know, even, you know, little things like, you know, we bought a new car, and then we see that brand of car, you know, that model everywhere. But in my case, you know, not long after he started, you know, he put the bug in my ear about simulation theory, I saw, you know, an interview with Elon Musk when he was at a tech conference, and someone asked him about simulation theory, and he said more or less that he thought it was more likely than unlikely, you know, and everybody on stage and in the audience is kind of laughing and they can't believe it, because, you know, up to this point, simulation theory was you know, pretty unusual. You know, you'd see it being talked about on Reddit threads and by, you know, video gamers, but, you know, he's one of the, you know, foremost tech giants, you know, on the planet. So him taking it seriously meant an awful lot. And then as I traced it back, and the way that he was framing his belief in simulation theory was actually a riff on, there was a philosopher, an Oxford philosopher named Nick Bostrom, who wrote a paper in 2003. You know, so this is 4 years after The Matrix. You know, 1999 is The Matrix film, which is, you know, what really mainstreamed the idea for a lot of people, was their first introduction to it. Although it's kind of interesting that in like the late 90s, there were a ton of those movies. You know, there mm-hmm. was there was The Matrix, but there was also The 13th Floor. There was also Dark City. There's also probably my favorite, Existenz, the David Cronenberg film. So it was a few years after those movies, and in a way, maybe that sequence is strange, that I might think that, you know, an Oxford philosopher publishing a major paper about the idea would have preceded those movies, though they were drawing on, you know, all sorts of inspirations themselves. But when Bostrom published this paper, he really had a very elegant kind of thought experiment that has captured a lot of people's imaginations, and Musk is kind of riffing on it at that conference. You know, and what he said was, here are three arguments, one of which must be true. First one is that any society that gets sufficiently advanced will make a simulation that is impossible to distinguish from reality. You know, and if you look around at where we're at in sort of the evolution of video games and artificial intelligence and simulations that are built, you know, for different industries, you can see that, you know, the rate that they're increasing is pretty incredible. You know, looking from Pong to Grand Theft Auto, you know, from the 70s to today is an unbelievable advancement that's, you know, possibly a faster one than the Wright brothers, you know, to landing on the moon.
Yeah.
His second argument is, the second proposition is, societies will, for reasons unknown, not make these simulations. And then the third is, oh, I may have misspoke it. Let me start again. It could be very
retake. Try again. Okay.
The first one is that the society doesn't last long enough to build that sort of simulation. Oh. That there's some kind of disaster or societal collapse that prevents us from reaching that stage. And, you know, when you're looking around, that's not completely unlikely.
Okay, I can go with that one.
Part two is, for some reason, we don't go down that path, you know, and we don't explore that technology. But that seems unlikely based on what we've been doing. Then the third is, any society, ours or possibly some other, that hits that level of technological sophistication will make simulations that are indistinguishable from reality. And as soon as they make two, the one original Real World is outnumbered.
Ooh.
And there's no reason that they would stop at two. You know, it would
Right.
most likely be an uncountable number. You know, especially we're talking about, you know, huge advances, you know, a huge stretch of time, you know, more or less unlimited. And, you know, running the statistics, if there are, you know, 1,000 times as many perfectly realistic simulated people as there are real original people, then statistically, it's more likely you're one of them.
Ooh. But they can't recreate the soul. Come on, no souls.
Maybe, maybe not.
Oh, no. Is this what you touch in the film?
Well, that idea is certainly discussed.
Okay.
You know, in fact, we talked to Nick Bostrom, who explains it that way.
Okay.
You know, in his papers, you know, it's not super long. It's easy to find on the internet. It's maybe about 10 pages, though it does get into math, which I will admit is beyond my capabilities to really understand. But the core of those three propositions is perfectly easy to grasp.
Are you going to try, or have you thought of, or have you maybe you've even done this? Are you going to try to get Elon in the film? Have you thought about that?
We've reached out to him. We have not been able to get him. But at this point, he's talked about, and we have clips of him. So the fact that he is on record as having talked about this is public knowledge and is sort of part of the story, that this idea, which is a pretty wild idea, is talked about both by, you know, science fiction fans and, you know, quote unquote, regular people, but also people who are incredibly sophisticated, you know, in the world of science.
Yeah. Okay. Well, Elon, if you're out there and you're listening to us, because you have to be a fan if you're thinking like that, he's got to be a fan of Coast to Coast. Elon, let us know. Let us know. Let's get in on that film too. That'd be awesome. That would be really cool.
Yeah. That would be unbelievable.
You can make it a simulation. Yeah. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
But again, that kind of stuff is sort of in the periphery of the film, is sort of the background, the orientation. The heart of it, you know, are people who believe it and who have had, you know, unusual experiences that informed their belief, and then the way they try to puzzle out the implications of what that means.
Well, I find it interesting that guy had said to you that the sleep paralysis is a part of that. I never thought about that. So I've been thinking about this as you've been talking about it. But again, I like to study all the genres, pull them together, see how they relate. And in the, well, let's see, the sleep paralysis part, a lot of times, you know, people see shadow people, other people see, you know, they're stuck because they see aliens there. They are zapped in the Bigfoot world. You know, everybody's frozen, missing time, all that kind of stuff relates with the sleep paralysis to different people. They see different things and feel different things. But each one of the genres have something similar to that and just different names. And to stop and go, okay, how does that relate to what the way the guy had described it? He thinks that's part of the simulation of the people that are running it. And I think he's nailed it, because it's true. They stop you and then they start you again. So that's, I like that. I think he's right on with that. Now, you've also said that it does touch on the Mandela effect a little bit too.
Yeah, well, absolutely. You know, and the Mandela effect, I'm not sure which caught on my radar first, you know, and at what point I put the two of them together. But, you know, the Mandela effect, where people distinctly remember things that turn out, you know, not to be true. You know, and I think the famous one, and I think the first one that I heard was, you know, the Berenstain Bears. You know, and many people, myself included, remember the name of the bears being spelled B-E-R-E-N-S-T-E-I-N. But It turns out it's STAIN, as in stain. You know, and it could be, well, that's funny. I mean, stain is probably a more common spelling, which may be the reason that we think of it. But, you know, so many people remember it so distinctly that it bothers them. You know, and there's, you know, websites where people catalog one after the other, after the other, after the other, and people debate whether, you know, these are, you know, collective mismemories, but, you know, sort of the big startling idea, you know, have you moved into an alternate, you know, universe, into an alternate simulation, or has the past been changed? And, you know, that kind of goes into two places. Like, on the one hand, you know, I think Nick Bostrom in particular has said that he doesn't find that stuff too persuasive, you know, that he thinks that remembering it wrong is more likely, or other strange coincidences. But the funny thing for me, you know, is somebody who that I keep going into in relation to this movie is the author Philip K. Dick, you know, who wrote the books that became Blade Runner and Minority Report and Total Recall, and The Man in the High Castle. And so lots of his books dealt with people who would move between one reality and another. And, you know, an interesting thing about him is at a certain point, he came to believe that that's the way the world really worked. You know, he had this dramatic sort of revelation in 1974. And there's a speech that he made in France in 1977 where, you know, he says flat out that he believed that we were living in a digital computer-created reality. And he went further to say that little mistakes, little changes, deja vu and, you know, seeing something being different than it was the day before is kind of a clue to it, and is a clue to people are sort of, that somebody is monkeying around, you know, with the past and with reality. So he seems, you know, the way I read it is it sounds like he is, you know, predicting, you know, the Mandela effect. But, you know, back in 1977.
It's scary to think about this. It gets so deep when, you know, as you're talking about it, I'm going, wait a minute. Yeah, we're the pawns. We're the ones inside the game. And it can be changed at any time. And when you do these things where you go out in the woods and you look for cryptids, and when you look up in the sky, and when you have experiences like I've had, and a lot of people with Coast, those of you out there listening right now, when we've had those experiences, it's, you know, they control time. They can stop you. They can stop your entire body except your eyes. I mean, come on. Is this true? Well, Rodney's got a great film coming out to talk about it. Connie Willis here with Rodney Ashner on Coast to Coast AM. It's Coast to Coast AM. Connie Willis here. We are talking with Rodney Ashner, film director and experiencer almost as well with all these same subjects that we're talking about. Rodney, before we go back to some of the questions that I want to ask you about the simulation show that you're doing right now, I want to tell you that I met somebody recently. It was at David Politis's Missing 411, his latest film, and it was a premiere that he had, and it was Jay Wiedner.
Great.
Yeah. So tell me about Jay. Yeah, he stuck out to me. I thought, what is going on with this guy? Why does he stick out so much in the crowd? And then we met, and what a cool dude. So tell me about him.
Yeah, well, Jay is one of the guys that we talked to in Room 237. And, you know, he's somebody who's, you know, watched The Shining again and again and again, and has gravitated to details that, you know, no one else has, that no one else has really seen. You know, the one that he talks about that, you know, certainly gets the most attention, you know, are the clues to, you know, to the moon landing, that he finds inside of The Shining. But he also had really interesting things to say about, like, the books that were on the table in the Denver apartment that the Torrance family lived in, and, like, the artwork on the walls. I mean, he clearly had the most active eyes, you know, the most attention to detail, you know, from almost anyone I've talked to about that movie.
That's great. Did he have something to do with The Nightmare, too?
No, he wasn't involved in that one.
Okay, I bet he's got some thoughts about that or some experiences about that, too. We took him out Bigfooting one time, Sasquatch Journey and myself, and, you know, he's got this great big property out in an area. I don't want to give too much information about where he lives exactly, but he's around some spooky areas, and now he's got some ideas of signs of Sasquatch. So I hope to go out there one day with him, because he, some of the things that he was shown, he said, "Oh, I've seen this before." So, and he's got a great mind, and he's quick with that camera too. So it was very nice meeting him. And as we were talking, we kind of learned along the way some of the different people we knew, and you were one of those people that we brought up, you know, "Oh yeah, Rodney." So that was pretty neat. Jay Wiener. Yeah. Yeah. Really, really neat guy too. So, okay. Going back to your latest film with the simulation theory, I guess, you know, I've got so many questions about it, but one of them is in the film technique that, to me, I find you so creative in and able to deliver that message that is creepy. And so that's my question is, how do you come up with some of these ideas? Like, everybody knows, one of the creepiest things about Jaws, the first Jaws, was what made it so creepy to most of us was the fact that the camera view was of the sharks. And that was creepy. You're like, "Oh my gosh, whoa." So how do you come up with those and be more creative, or do you attempt to be more creative, or you just, you know, whatever happens kind of thing happens? Or do you work at it? Are there tips and tricks to that?
Well, I mean, I do get kind of conceptual, right? So, you know, in the case of 237, there's a little original photography, but most of it is archives. Though I did find, you know, a really interesting thing is that the same shot in a different place can have a very different meaning. You know, and within that, you know, we use a lot of footage from The Shining and some other Kubrick films. But within that, there's a Russian film technique that goes way back called the Kuleshov effect, which is exactly that point, that the same shot in a different context has a different meaning. And Lem Kuleshov, the Russian filmmaker, did an experiment where he took a very neutral shot of an actor, you know, just sort of looking off camera, and then intercut it into different scenes. So in one scene, he's looking at a bowl of soup. In another, he's looking at his wife. In a third, he's looking at a sleeping child. And they would talk to the audience after they see each version and ask him about his performance. And they all talked about how sensitive he looked, or how, you know, how hungry he looked, you know, how passionate he looked. And it was all the same neutral expression. You know, the actor who was being filmed had no idea where the shot was going to be used. And because we talk a lot about film theory within 237, it seemed like a really interesting challenge in that one to try to use the same shots to mean different things. Like, a very simple way is that, you know, we have a lot of shots of Jack Nicholson. Sometimes he represents Jack Nicholson. Sometimes he represents Jack Torrance. Sometimes he represents, you know, the person telling the story. Sometimes he represents Stanley Kubrick. You know, and without needing a caption or anything like that, people are able to make that jump. And often, you know, it's kind of eerie, you know, in the music. Like, I was talking about Jonathan Snipes, who does music and sound design on these projects, does so much to inform the mood. You know, The Nightmare is mostly reenactments. So we decided to use, you know, to be slightly conceptual, that we would shoot it all within a soundstage and embrace sort of the artificiality of the soundstage, but make it sort of a dreamlike place where like the blacks kind of went on forever, and to try to draw kind of a metaphor between the spirit realm or your imagination and the soundstage, and the way that actors can move from one set to another is similar to the way that like these spirits could move effortlessly through time and space to different people. And in this one, you know, we're, the simple thing that we're doing is, you know, we're talking about a world created in a computer. We're doing everything within the computer. You know, all the reenactments are going to be done, you know, with computer animation, and we're looking at sort of Google Earth like interfaces to set them in the locations that people are talking about in their stories. you know, so it's they draw on different skill sets in a way, and sometimes, you know, they involve, you know, recruiting different people to be part of the project. But I know I kind of hyper obsess on, you know, what's going to be the way that we do this, and what does that have to say about, you know, the greater project.
I'm glad you do. I like that. I like that you do. Have you, so what would be the tip or the trick about, and I don't know if I can word this correctly, but I do know that there's a lot of scenes out there in the world that are the creepiest, is when the filmmaker puts it out there and then they don't give you in detail and the actual what's going on. They let the audience kind of let their own mind go crazy and put it together themselves. And I think each individual does that, and it's even scarier than what the filmmaker would make, because our minds take it a whole lot. We go into other areas, right? So how do you provoke that? Because I've seen that before, and I'm like, oh my gosh, yeah, I took it somewhere that nobody else could have taken it. But obviously everybody else does the same thing. But that is a really nice trick to do, is have the audience put it in their mind in such a way. How do you lead them like that? Is there a trick to that?
It's a trick, and it's a balance. You know, some people get frustrated if you don't give them, you know, enough information. But, you know, go back to The Shining. You know, there's a ton of, there's, you know, a couple things happening in that movie. There's a lot of ambiguity, you know, and the movie ends, you know, with sort of a puzzle. You know, I compare it to, you know, The Sixth Sense, which is a, you know, a great little jewel box of a horror movie. But the biggest difference is that it ends with a very clear explanation of everything that happened.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very satisfying in the moment, but I never felt, you know, I still haven't felt a need to go to revisit it and watch it again since then.
Right.
You know, I watched it once, enjoyed it, and was very satisfied. But The Shining always leaves you a little unsettled and completely unsatisfied. And I watch it again and again, you know, before even, you know, the project, to try to say, oh, at what point does it stop making sense? Where do I lose it? This time I'm going to watch it more carefully and I'm going to understand it. And I think that's maybe one of the reasons that so many people, you know, have spent so much time trying to decode the movie, you know, because it is a puzzle and it feels like some pieces are missing, you know, or don't fit together perfectly. You know, I think a more modern, you know, version of that, you know, in a movie that I just love is Under the Skin, which is very, very minimal and you know, leaves all sorts of questions about what are we seeing, who are these characters, you know, what are they doing and why. You know, it's also completely terrifying in its way, you know, if you've seen it. There's like the most harrowing scene on a beach, where Scarlett Johansson is, you see, she's sort of a vampire from outer space, but when you say it like that, it sounds like a much broader, campier movie than it is, because it's a very withholding, a minimalist kind of movie. And there's a family who gets stuck in the water, one after the other after the other, and it's so cold and so cruel and so terrifying, but you're seeing it through the eyes of these aliens who don't really understand people or care about them. And very little is explained, especially as she lures people into this like house that's bigger on the inside than it is on the outside, that's full of this black void with like a reflective floor, which is a fairly simple effect to do technically, but it's so eerie. It's so atmospheric, you know, and they never explain exactly what she's doing. You kind of get it. You kind of get the sense of it. You know, it's just, you know, as far as horror movies go, it's pretty unbelievable.
It's under my skin, under your skin?
Under the skin.
Under the
skin. Jonathan Glazer directed it with Scarlett Johansson a couple of years ago.
Sounds great. I got to watch that one. That sounds awesome. I like you it know, when it's that way.
Yeah, I mean, I wish my movies had a little more air in them, actually, because sometimes they can be wall-to-wall talking, and I admire movies that have a lot of space inside of them. You know, mm-hmm. The Babadook did, too. That was a very effective movie.
Well, maybe you can do that in this one you're doing now. You still have time.
Yeah, I'm trying to. Well, but there's so many ideas that I want to jam into it, and then it threatens to get too long. So it's always that's always a struggle to get everything in, but to also give it, you know, room to breathe.
I gotcha. I like that. Yeah, well, you know what? Some of them beg for that, and it just happens naturally. And you kind of let things happen naturally as well. One of the movies that's not really, I don't know, I guess you would call it kind of spooky, that you go to, and at least me, that I was never satisfied, but I did not want to go back again, was Clockwork Orange. I was like, sure. What is this? I don't want to see it again. Maybe it was my age at the time or whatever, but one of them, and it wasn't a spooky one, but you know, I understand what you're talking about when you want to go back to these films. It was when I was in college and I was doing a film class and I had to critique it, and it was Amadeus. And thank goodness it was something worthy to go back and critique, because there were so many symbolisms, there were so many things going on. But when you get a horrible movie to have to do that to, oh, it's like you said, you know, you're satisfied, you're done, you've seen it, and it's gone from your head, actually. And you just move on. And I've seen so many movies like that along the way where, okay, I saw it. It was fun for that 2 hours or whatever it was. And you go on. You don't even talk about it sometimes. There's so many like that. But thank you for not having those. Yours make you think. And they're very interesting. And you're like, where did that come from? Who had that perspective? And I just appreciate that in you and the fact that they are spooky and creepy, and it comes from an experience, and you allow it to breathe and to come to life. So thank you for that.
Well, thanks. I appreciate that. You know, and I think part of it, and some people find them a little frustrating because, you know, I don't typically give clear answers to these questions. You know, I don't come out and say, this is the definitive interpretation of The Shining, or this is exactly what's happening in sleep paralysis. You know, they're meant to inspire questions as much as to, you know, show you the way that these folks experience these things. And, you know, I think not to spoil the film, but I'll be surprised if by the time this film is finished that we have a locked 100% crystal clear answer about whether or not we're living in a simulation.
Well, you know what? In the films that you do, there's really no answer. The people that can relate to that and go, oh my gosh, I love that film, they do get satisfied because they've experienced it, and now they get to see it done in a film, and the perspective is correct, because that's what I saw when I saw it. I went, oh my gosh, that's right. And I know some people see this. I've seen that, and I think you've nailed it. I think the people on the outside that have never even heard of it or thought about it, and because they've never experienced it or don't have someone in their family or friends that have, and that those may be the people too that are like, what's going on with this Rodney dude? I don't know, but I'm not coming back. But people like us are like, come on, Rodney, give us more. Now, just so what is the name of the film as of right now that you're
right
creating
now,
with The Matrix?
A Glitch in the Matrix. Mm-hmm. Which is, you know, going back to the Mandela effect, there's a moment within, you know, the first Matrix film where he and Trinity and his team, they're going up a staircase of a building within the Matrix, and he sees the same cat do the same walk through a door twice in a way that's very strange. And he mentions it sort of off the cuff And his team realizes that that's a clue that the Matrix is being manipulated with, right? Like strange glitches, repetitions, déjà vus.
Mm-hmm.
Is it déjà vu? However that is.
Déjà vu.
whatever is the plural. And then that's also become a very interesting, you know, sort of Reddit page where people talk about sort of unexplained things that they think might be clues to whether it's simulation theory or some other kind of unexplainable mystery, but they catalog. Like I was at home with my sister and she was asleep, and then I went outside, and then she came home and walked past me and went inside the house. You know, sort
Didn't
of
see you.
Strange little single little things that happen that feel like, if this were, you know, a computer program, a mistake.
That makes sense. I gotcha. Boy, that reminds me of something. I can't catch it. Maybe a little deja vu myself. So I want to thank you for being with us, but tell us when the film is coming out and where else we can find you and what else is going on with you.
Sure. Well, it's, you know, we're deep into it now. Hopefully it'll be finished, you know, in the first half of next year, but, you know, we'll see how long it takes to do the animation. For the most part, you know, the interviews are mostly edited, and we're working on the animation and the other footage to go through there, but, you know, still researching a couple of stray ends. We're on tour, kind of, with a sort of a punk rock movie about a guy who had an incredibly offensive punk rock band back in the 80s and 90s. And, you know, it gets into questions that are impossible to answer about, you know, separating the art from the artist. If somebody plays a bad guy on stage, and in this case, it was a jaw-droppingly bad guy that he would play on stage. And does that mean that he's a monster in real life? You know, and
maybe, maybe not. Well, you know what? You can learn it all, RodneyAsher.com. Rodney, thank you. Connie Willis here. Open Lines coming up next on Coast to Coast AM.